We are in Proverbs. And we are in Proverbs for the last time. We've been working on this since last September. A huge book to begin with. One which is not easy to take, you know, in smaller bites, if you will, because each individual verse really is worth a great deal of study. And so, done the best that we could with the time that we have to try to cover the great majority of it, at least to see the larger themes and topics, and here of late to look then into the latter chapters especially, and see verses that deal with tonight, you know, such as this. We're going to look at only three categories this evening. The first one we're going to go through rather very quickly. Greed is always in my life at least been best exemplified, you know, Scrooge McDuck there when I was a child. But just a couple of verses, really, I have four, I think it is, on the topic of greed. So let's start in Proverbs chapter 11 and look at verse 6. The righteousness of the upright will deliver them, but the treacherous will be caught by their own greed. We will have to go quickly tonight. We actually have quite a few verses to consider, as I say, in three different categories. But let's say, you know, just this one thing about that one. Isn't ambition something that is really important and valuable to try to teach your children? And it is. And isn't the desire to do well in life a wholesome and healthy and happy and good thing, you know? And you want that for your children and your grandchildren and grandchildren after you. But there is a fine line. There's a difficult place there where you lose control in your ambition to have the things of this life become a major problem. Both the Old Testament and the New Testament counsel us against covetousness. The very Ten Commandments deal with covetousness, actually in two different forms, the desire for things as well as the desire for someone else's mate. And so this is obviously a great trial or temptation that all of us can face. But what is it that delivers the upright? It is their righteousness. But the treacherous will be caught by their own greed. And there, within the verse, you know, is planted the thought that greed leads one to treachery. If you lose control of that desire for the things of this life, that you're also losing the discipline to participate only in righteousness. You are tempted now to go for those things in a cruel way, in an unrighteous manner, to the detriment and the harm of others. You know, don't have a problem in the world with a guy who goes out and spends 10 years of his life digging a gold mine, you know, and coming out of there a multi-gazillionaire. You know, we're happy for him. But there's an awful lot of ways that you can wind up making money on somebody else's back. We just have to be really careful for that. Does that mean then that this is a temptation only for people who are really wealthy? No, as a matter of fact, brethren, I suggest to you that perhaps some of the greediest people on the whole planet are the people who don't have very much. Their hunger to have more becomes really pretty powerful. You go without, you develop, you know, an urgent and maybe all-possessing desire to get out of those more miserable and trying circumstances. Greed is across the board, you know, a trial, no matter what place you are in life. Once heard a guy say that he really didn't want to be extremely wealthy and he didn't want to be a giant landowner. He just only always wanted the property that was next door to his. There's no end to that until what? Until you've covered, you know, the whole planet. So hard to tell where to draw that line, perhaps. I think it comes differently for each and every individual. I had an elder one time very many years ago, and I had just very high regard for way back in the 70s. He's been deceased now for a long time, but you know, he once told a class he was teaching of young preachers, you know, and he said, guys, there's a lot of temptations in the world. But you're going to find out that they're pretty specific to the individual. Now, he was happily married, lots of kids and all the rest of that, but he said, I just have to tell you, when it comes to sex, I just don't really have a big temptation for that, he said. That's just one that hasn't, you know, been really big for me. But he said, money is a temptation. You know, both of us agreed, if you will. And he just recognized, you know, everybody's different. This one, the lust for money, of course, Jesus also touched upon. Difficult to enter the kingdom with those kind of desires. So then in 26, he who withholds grain, the people will curse him, but blessing will be on the head of him who sells it. So, be involved in commerce, recognize that if you get kind of very stingy, you know, and other people are suffering because of it, if you're not sort of distributing the wealth right there, you know, it's going to be a problem. That the people will curse you for that, will hate you for that. It's not going to be worth it. It's not worth the income. Chapter 27, all the way down at verse 20, Sheol and Abaddon are never satisfied, nor are the eyes of man ever satisfied. That is the fact of the matter. And it's been kind of interesting for me just in this last year. You all know Don and I are shopping for houses. Believe it or not, we're going to race out of here immediately after this assembly tonight. Houses are selling in less than 24 hours, so now we've got to the point where we have to jump and run. One got listed, you know, here today, and so I'll call my real estate agent. She's going to meet us at 8:15, you know, to go look at a house. I have been looking at houses for a year. You would think that I would just be utterly, completely, totally tired of seeing the inside of anybody else's house. And there are days when I can feel that way. And yet I found myself looking at that website again just yesterday at a house that's been listed for over 6 months that I know is not the least bit viable. I don't like the neighborhood. I don't like the size of the house. I know I don't like that house. But it's got a really interesting bathroom that I'd like to see. It's so, for 6 months, I keep going back to this. Look at that picture. I've only got one picture. And there's all kinds of glass and chrome and tile. And there's this curved thing in there. And I can't figure out from the picture if it actually has an entrance from both sides into the shower. Or if I'm looking at a reflection, what is that? But it looks like a really pretty bathroom. And I think the kind of general kind of got that just about ready to call a real estate agent and say, I'd like to see that bathroom. You can't do that to people. But what's happening there? Friends, you never get tired. The eyes are just bottomless, and so are the ears and all the rest of your senses, the way that it is. Okay? And so knowing that will help us to control these kinds of desires. And the book of Proverbs, of course, reminds us with these several different statements about these various aspects and how troublesome that they can be. But just recognize, now what is it, verse 20 here, I lost my place. Sheol and Abaddon are never satisfied. In other words, have we ever had a day where all of a sudden the universe declared, well, I don't think anybody will die today? It doesn't happen. You know, or, you know, the sign out in front that says, no occupancy. Can't happen, can it? And so to be compared to that, to the maw of death, you know, itself, and to say then that your eyes are just going to always want to be looking at, you know, the shiny little baubles of life is a warning. That's right. Be careful. Chapter 30, next to the last chapter in the book, and down at verses 15 and 16, tied together there, 15 and 16, the rod and reproof gives wisdom, but a child who gets his own way, oh, I'm in 29, that won't work. 15 of chapter 30, the leech has two daughters. What are their names? Give and give. I met a guy in 1975 who's been a lifelong friend, member of the church when we first moved up to Kirkwood there, and he had two kids. And the first time I met him, he said, well, here, you know, here are my boys. Here's Pete and Repeat. Okay. Well, of course, he's just pulling my leg. But forever after, I'm going to remember him. Whenever I read this verse right here, if you can't think of any other name for your kids than give, you know, what about your kids? Well, as a matter of fact, what are all leeches like? What do they do? Did they ever kick back you on a recliner with a glass of lemonade and say, I'm not hungry? Don't do it. So in chapter 30, verse 15, Leach has two daughters, give. And there are three things that will not be satisfied, four that will not say enough. Sheol, we just saw that back in chapter 27, and the barren womb, and fire that never says enough. Sheol, the barren womb, the earth that is never satisfied with water, and fire that never says enough. Solomon just observes the way the world works. Now, when he gives you these illustrations, of course, he's just trying to help us to understand, though, and we don't want to live a life of dissatisfaction like that. We don't want to live a life of unhappiness. We want to live a life of constant craving. We don't want to be leeches. We don't want to be, you know, any of these things. The unhappiness that attends them, that is just never ending, is to be avoided. So, we've already had a whole section on money. We looked at a ton of verses on money. I'm not going to go to any of those unless Eileen wants me to. Okay, I missed the first part, but if I get what you're saying, you know, I think what it is, give and give, is that this poor father is always hearing from the daughters what?
Gimme.
You know, I got two kids and their names are gimme, 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 gimme. Okay, I think that's the idea. You know, he's on the receiving end of that. Okay? Okay, so let's go on then to this topic of justice. And once again, there are not a whole lot of verses on the subject, but in chapter 18 now, and back in verse 17, I apologize for my throat right here, I got some kind of deal going on, but chapter 18 and verse 17, the first to plead his case seems just until another comes and examines him. Now, as a matter of fact, you know, everybody's got their favorite verses, and this would be in my top 10 list, you know, I think. It's so obvious. But also, you know, for preachers especially, it is just the story of our lives, and it drives us crazy. And today, I have the most wonderful story to give you an illustration of this. Okay, I was riding my bicycle. I told you, you know, I exercise on the bike. So I was out riding my bicycle here a couple of weeks ago, and I saw two Mormon lads wearing their uniforms, you know, walking along the bicycle trail. And I told you that. And so I stopped my bike. And I said, hi, now I know you guys are not allowed to study with anybody that knows the Bible, and I know you're not allowed to study with anybody more than a couple of times. You're shielded from anybody who knows what they're talking about. But I got to commend you for believing that your church is the only church, because I believe my church is the only church, and I can commend you for going out and trying to get people to change their minds and be persuaded to come over to your church. I've spent my whole life trying to persuade people to come over and be a part, you know, of the church that I'm a part of. So I appreciate, you know, the work that you're doing. But I know you're not allowed to do what you're asking everybody else to do. So I just wanted to give you my card. Oh, I always got them. So just give you my card and say, if you ever would be willing to examine your own religion with somebody who knows the Bible, then I would really like to study with you. Okay? So, if you were ever of a mind to hear the other side of the story, I'll be available for you. Well, what did they immediately do? Oh, boy, we want all part of that. You bet. Sure, we'll do that. So, they came into my home. First time they came into my home, I told them, I know that you will not be allowed to come back. The world record in my 40 years of dozens and dozens of men just like yourself is twice. No one of you Mormon missionaries is ever going to come back a third time. And I've also noticed that none of you ever keeps your word. So, after we finished that first discussion, I made them promise me that I would have equal time and they would come back next time, and that they were giving their word of honor, and that if they broke it, it was their integrity that was at stake. That was the end of the first meeting. They came back for the second meeting. And they brought an older guy there who pretty well hogged the time, you know, and all that sort of thing. And they showed me this lengthy video, and I didn't even get 20% of the time. It wasn't the least bit, you know, fair. And I told them all over again, I know you guys can't come back. Are you promising me with your word of honor, your integrity, your dignity at stake, that you'll come back a third time? Absolutely. And then I got a call in about 2 days. Well, we decided that it'll take too much time to study with you, so we're not going to study with you anymore. I told you you would do that. You are not a man of honor. And that's bad. You at least ought to develop a character that is trustworthy and believable. Because you're not trustworthy or believable, I don't see any reason why I or anybody else, you know, should pay attention and believe anything that you say. So, the guy made all kinds of excuses, you know, hung up the phone. Here's where it starts getting interesting. I think I've told you this much already. So, about a week went by, and lo and behold, I was driving my car, we came real close together, and there he was on the sidewalk, and we made eye contact. He knew me, and I knew him. Another few days or a week went by, and we made eye contact somewhere else in town. There he was again. Okay? And so, Monday night I had these Bible studies I've told you about. I was talking to one of the men that I work with every Monday night on the phone, and he had a Mormon friend that had come, and we'd stay with him, so he's very interested in the Mormons. And I said, you know what? God tells me something, but if I see that guy again, I know exactly what I'm going to do. Here's what I'm going to do. And do you know what happened in less than 12 hours the next day? I got off the freeway to the Beltline, to get onto the River Road, so I need to go to the post office, and there he was crossing the street on the other side. And by the time I had turned right and then left at the first light and made the left into the parking lot at the bus station, he was meeting me coming across the bus station right there. And I just drove right up and stopped and rolled down my window, and there we were, face to face. So I said to him yesterday, is your conscience bothering you any? He smiled kind of sheepishly, and he said, well, no. And so then I turned to the other new young Mormon that I've never laid eyes on before, and I said, well, I told this man that I had never met an honest Mormon in 40 years who would keep his word, and that's dozens of times. They'll come twice and never the third time. They will swear on their word of honor that they'll be back, and they never do. I warned him that, I told him that, and then I turned to the kid, you know, and I said, and what happened? That's right, you didn't come back. So I said, okay, you can redeem your integrity, though. You could redeem your honor and be a person who is trustworthy anytime you want to call me back and come study with me again. Boy, was he on the spot. But he wouldn't do it. Okay, so off he goes again. Now what's all of that got to do with this proverb? Brethren, the problem with Mormons and Baptists and Seventh-day Adventists and just about all the rest of them is that the first to plead his case seems just. So, if you've been raised up in Mormonism or raised up in Catholicism or raised up in any other ism, it all sounds true. Because what? The first to plead his case sounds just until another comes and examines him. So the foundation of the whole religious world, brethren, is avoiding anybody ever examining you. This is the primary reason I think we don't have any debates these days. It's because, you know, people just, for a variety of reasons we talked about last week, but you know, people really don't like to do that. They just don't have the courage, they don't have the knowledge, they don't have a lot of things, you know, to examine it. And it drives preachers crazy. That's crazy. And nobody seems, you know, is willing to examine their religion. Now, we're, of course, exempt from that because we just have the truth, right? This verse doesn't apply to us. What church were you raised in? Do you know why you are a member of a Church of Christ? Could you say for certain that you know if you were not born into a Baptist household that you wouldn't be a Baptist? Raise your hand if you were raised in a home of Christians. Okay. Now, as a matter of fact, that's surprising to me. I think that's about the highest percentage I've ever seen. It's been my experience in 40 years of being a Christian then churches of Christ, above all others, you will find a higher percentage of people that have converted from something else to be a part of this, if they were not raised by Christian parents. Just to say, you are really blessed to have such a high percentage that got all that foundation, you know, underneath you. But it also means it's even more difficult for you to obey a passage like that, to really test it, to work it out, to make absolutely certain that the things you believe are considered, that they are reasonable, that they have passed tests, that you're sure that you have done what we're asking everybody else to do. Examine their religion to see whether or not it is true. So that's one of my favorite ones. And I'm grateful now that, of course, we mentioned last week, looks like we're shaping up to be able to have a discussion. A debate is probably not the proper term, I don't think, actually, for what I'm envisioning anyway, with the Seventh-day Adventist preachers, a guy I think you really like. Not really an honorable guy, not Mormonish at all. I've been studying with him for 2.5 years, 90 minutes every Monday night, 2.5 years. He only misses, you know, when he really has to be. Not Mormonish at all. He is a guy who is just absolutely convinced that what he believes is true, and he's going to rise up and defend it. And you have to give a man high marks for that. You really do. I don't care if he's an atheist. If he'll defend what he believes, if he knows something about it, and his conviction is enough that he's willing to face somebody that disagrees with him, that is a mark of high honor. It is a search for justice. It is a search for truth. Not everybody's going to find it. It's a straight and narrow path for those that do, but that's an honorable trait. We all just want to try and cultivate is the word I'm looking for. Inculcate kept coming to mind, which works too, but not quite as thoroughly. Okay, got to put two together now. So turn over to chapter 22. But before we read it, get chapter 22. Just hold it with your finger there, and then come over to chapter 23. And, I guess our adjoining pages probably won't have to do much turning. But look at 22 and 28. Do not move the ancient boundary which your fathers have set. Not much you can say about that, is there? Just a straight command. Chapter 23 and verse 10, look at this. Do not move the ancient boundary or go into the fields of the fatherless, for their Redeemer is strong. He will plead their case against you. Now, brethren, back in the old days, it was pretty hard to find a land office, wasn't it? It's pretty hard to find a surveyor. It's pretty hard, to say for absolutely certain that here is, by everybody's account, the very precise borders, you know, of my property as opposed to yours. What were they mostly using? Piles of stones. And what do you do with piles of stones? You can move piles of stones. Not hard to do. And so, you know, you can steal from people that way. You can have a whole war to get started that way, and have. And so twice we have this declaration, we have this prohibition, we have this command, we have this, you know, unarguable statement of fact, you don't do this, don't move the ancient boundary. And it says, or go into the fields of the fatherless. Now, go into is not talking about cutting through because it's a shortcut to school in the morning. You know, going through means you're gleaning. You're taking something away, you know, from their crops. You're taking away from them something that obviously, being fatherless, is going to be even more precious to them. They've got a harder road that they're working with right there. Don't you treat people that are weaker than you or have more difficult circumstances than you, you know, any differently than you do everybody else. That's not an opportunity at all. And that because, and this ought to get everybody's attention there in verse 11, their Redeemer is strong and he'll plead their case against you. Boy, if you go to court and you meet God as the opposing lawyer, you're kind of in trouble there, aren't you? It's not an argument you're likely to win. Chapter 24, verses 11 and 12. Deliver those who are being taken away to death. And those who are staggering to slaughter, oh, hold them back. If you say, see, we did not know this, does he not consider it who weighs the hearts? Does he not know it who keeps your soul? And will he not render to man according to his works. This little collection on justice, especially these last two, are really pretty fearsome, aren't they? They're meeting God as the prosecuting attorney, and you're in the defense right there. And this all-powerful God, when he pleads his case, is not likely to lose, and especially in verse 12, if he knows the hearts and keeps your soul and renders to man according to his work. So, if you had to pick one word that's really talking about what you should never do, what does this whole collection put a really powerful motivator on to get you never to offer what? One word. Starts with an E. Excuses. Okay? This is all about you seeing somebody that's in need, and then what? Well, just washing your hands of the matter and saying, I didn't know. Well, there doesn't seem to be much excuse for that. Apparently, you should have known. And that is not going to be an excuse. And by the way, just for fun, in any legal system, ignorance of the law, is that an excuse? You are subject to the law whether you know what the law is or not. And you'll get your ticket or you'll have your day in court or whatever else. If you break a law, you get caught at it. Saying, I didn't know, hasn't got anything to do with it. You're supposed to be alert enough that you're paying attention. You have some kind of knowledge about how these things work. And so, since it's your responsibility to know the law, and those who have made the law have provisions for enforcement, then you need to be awfully careful about making sure you don't ever offer this flimsiest of all excuses called ignorance. Ignorance doesn't forgive anybody ever. Ignorance is no excuse whatsoever. But this, brethren, this is about people again. We've seen it before in other passages as well as tonight. We're talking about people who have a problem. Verse 11, deliver those who are being taken away to death. Those who are staggering to slaughter. Hold them back. What does that sound like? If they're being taken away to death, then what? Pardon me?
Bringing forth death.
Okay, I'm not sure I know what you mean, Michael, but what I'm getting at is...
Bringing forth slaughter, I assume that somebody was coming out, somebody would...
Yeah, that's it. See, they're being dragged away. Somebody's got them. Somebody's after them, And if somebody's being dragged away to slaughter or death, then there must be somebody who's doing a lot to them. Dragging them away. And now you're just a bystander watching this happen. And what is this verse saying we're supposed to do? Intervene. Wow. Wouldn't your first thought be, none of my business? Yeah, it would be. Remember, I know we have a highly developed police force and all the rest of that. So did the Jews at various times in their lives. Probably this is dealing with somebody who's being assaulted or something like that. I don't know. But it lays a weight of responsibility on us that there's no excuse for protecting those who need your help. In circumstances like these, which would be the scariest I can imagine. Because if man A is dragging person B off to death, then man A might have the power to drag who off to death? C. Me. Okay? See what I think was.
I think there's a connection with this verse, and am I my brother's keeper?
There you go. You bet. You bet. I don't think the Lord is very pleased at all with that argument, if you will. Am I my brother's keeper? What's the answer to that question? You are. That's not a rhetorical question at all. That's a statement of fact. Yes, you are. Okay, we must turn. Chapter 24, verses 23 through 26. These also are sayings of the wise. To show partiality in judgment is not good. He who says to the wicked, You are righteous. Peoples will curse him. Nations will abhor him. But to those who rebuke the wicked will be delight, and a good blessing will come upon them. He kisses the lips who gives a right answer. You don't show partiality. So you would never say to the wicked that they're righteous. It doesn't matter how powerful they are. It doesn't matter how wealthy they are. It doesn't matter how beholden you may be to them for some reason in the family or who knows what. You don't excuse wickedness. Wickedness needs to be opposed, exposed, expunged. You got to get rid of that stuff. So, and if you don't, if you justify people that are wicked, you know, the whole nation knows that and will abhor you. But to those who rebuke the wicked will be delight. A good blessing will come upon them. Now, I know what you're thinking, because I think exactly the same thing. In our society now, don't think ours is so unique in all the history of the world. You know, there are certain favored classes now. You know, homosexuals chief among them. You're just not allowed to say that is wickedness, that is sin, that is evil, that is something God will judge you for, that is intolerable, you need to stop behaving this way. It's not allowed. Okay? If you do that, then what are you going to get from the world? Okay? So you think, the nations aren't going to, you know, praise you for that. They're going to come down on you for that. Well, that's true. You know, it's always been true, and in every culture, it just depends on what the thing is you're talking about. You know, what if you were a Hellenist in Jesus' time? What if you were a Sadducee talking to a Pharisee? You know, all the same things going on. You know, and so ultimately, though, it doesn't matter whether you're a scribe, a Pharisee, a Sadducee, a Hellenist, or a Herodian. You know, in the end, what matters? Righteousness. Righteousness needs to be uplifted. And wickedness needs to be criticized. And isn't anybody else's job but us. Not the government's job. See, I didn't know. You know, it was up to them. Brethren were the light of the world. It's on our shoulders first. Okay, 28:5. Chapter 28, verse 5. Looks like this is going to go pretty well. I'm getting on down through this. 28:5. Okay, evil men do not understand justice, but those who seek the Lord understand all things. And that's the problem. Because they are utterly blind. They are utterly corrupted. They have lost all their moral bearings. They turn night into day. They don't know what righteousness is. They've redefined it all. You know, they have, what was it, famous politician, something about, defining deviancy down. Isn't that the phrase? Like, defining deviancy down. Well, it's been going on since the dawn of mankind, and it's going on right now. So in 28:5, brethren, no! They won't understand it. Yes! You're going to have your hands full in argument, you know, is going to go on. True enough. Is that any reason for us not to raise our voices against sin? No, it just isn't. Okay, and the last one here in this topic is verse 21, and we'll have a few in the last category. 28:21. To show partiality is not good. I've already had that verbatim. Because for a piece of bread a man will transgress. In other words, you'd be surprised at how little a bribe really needs to be. You might just be amazed to find out how much justice you can corrupt, you know, with just a loaf of bread. You know, something really, really, really small. But don't find out because you're offering the bread. Okay? But that never happened. Bill, did you have your hand up? Nope. Oh, okay. All right, so, you did? Okay, go ahead.
Esau gave up his birthright. And that is a huge thing in that culture to give up.
Oh, yeah.
Just rashly making a stupid decision.
Yeah, got himself in a world of trouble. As a result, later, when you know, a lot of people changed their minds, couldn't get it done either. But there you are. You know, there you are. And so he had a moment of weakness, and that trial, maybe going back to the greed again a little bit too, you know, not so sure, you know, really cost it. But there it is. For a little bit. 30 pieces of silver, brethren. 30 pieces. Is that just a princely sum? No, it's not. Not even. 30 pieces. Right? And then what did he do with them? Threw them away from him when he realized what he had done. The horror of it all. And hung himself for the shame and the grief of this crime that he had committed. Greed and justice really go together much of the time too. Let there be no partiality. Really hard to do. We are all of us creatures that are on frequencies, I guess is what you want to call it. But everybody is a certain kind of a person. And certain kinds of people will appeal to you. You'll immediately feel more comfortable with them. I don't know why it is. Sometimes you bump into somebody and then you just say, I like them immediately when I first met them. You don't know why. So they're just radiating some kind of magnetism or whatever it is. And when you've got a connection with somebody like that, and you just can't get enough of them, you enjoy every moment, you spend lots of time together, and then they do something wrong. What's your job? Go and point out the error. Do what you can to rectify it. This is our lot in life as Christians. Now, let's close up with a few thoughts on the topic of prayer. There's only a total of 5 verses, as a matter of fact. Let's have a look at that as we close out this great book. Chapter 15 and verse 8. The sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination to the Lord. That's the strongest term I guess there is for revulsion and disgust. It's to hate a thing. It's just utterly reprehensible and revolting. But the prayer of the upright is his delight. Every time a wicked person brings a sacrifice to God, how does God feel about it? Worst kind of disgust. But the prayer of the upright is his delight. Now, by the way, I think there's a contrast there in maybe 2 ways. But which would cost you more? A sacrifice or a prayer? Well, sure, a sacrifice. It's going to cost money, and be an animal that you either raised or had to go purchase or maybe some other product in the field or whatever, but it's a sacrifice. That's what the word means. A prayer is a pretty easy thing to offer, isn't it? So here you got in value, you might say, 2 ends of the spectrum. But the one that God responds to is the lesser expensive, but it is the prayer of the upright. Also in chapter 15, over in verse 29, the Lord is far from the wicked, but he hears the prayer of the righteous. He hears every prayer. We're hoping everybody offers some pretty fervent ones here for the Chambers and for the Lightning Bolts, for the Rolsons, for some of the others that have been suffering for years from various infirmities. God hears those prayers. They matter to him. They're powerful. He's responsive. But he isn't even in the same county with the wicked. Chapter 20, verse 25. It is a snare for a man to say rashly, it is holy, and after the vows, to make inquiry. What did my little 19-year-old Mormon buddy just do? It's that very thing. If it says it is holy, what is it talking about? Any number of ways that you can set a thing apart for some kind of service. It can be as simple as your word that you will go and you will do a thing. Okay? Or it can be as much as dedicating, in fact, in the Old Testament, even a child to the service of, say, Samuel. Okay? And so, it could be pretty dramatic to say the least, but it's a snare. If you don't think of that, you go pop off trying to please God with promises you can't keep. And then after you make the vow, you start asking questions. It's too late for that now. So what's the implication of that last phrase in that verse? When was the time for inquiry? Before you made the promise. Don't make the promise before you think about it. And once you've made the promise, then what? You're beholden. You got to keep the promise. Excuse me. chapter 28 and verse 9. 28:9. He who turns away his ear from listening to the law, even his prayer is an abomination. Now, I've been fond of saying for probably over 30 years now, ask most people, when do they think the greatest amount of sin is committed? What day of the week and what time? And what will most people pick? Friday or Saturday, and then what? In the nighttime. Brethren, I have no doubt in my mind, more sin is committed on Sunday mornings between the hours of about 10 and noon than any other time. What's happening then? It's when the majority of the United States of America get together to do what? Offer prayers and engage in religious exercises that are an abomination before the God of heaven. They've created their own religion. It is absolutely infuriating to him that people do this. So in 28 and in verse 9, he who turns away his ear from listening to the law, especially if he's sitting in a pew and trying to wear the name of Christ, but he has no interest in that law, no commitment to that law, isn't trying to learn that law, couldn't tell you anything about that law, can't find his way around in that law, he's been turning away his ear from listening to the law. Even his prayer is an abomination. Those are strong words. But of course, that doesn't apply to anybody who's in a building that wears the sign that says Church of Christ. Because once you pass under that archway, then you're cool, right? Brethren, you, above all people, whose responsibility is it to be absolutely certain that we are turning our ears where? To the law. Turning our ears to the law. You're looking for that above all else. If you want a prayer answered, then what should you have been listening to? The law. Okay? Law in the Old Testament and, of course, in the New Testament. 28:13, and then we'll start some closing remarks. 28, chapter 13. He who conceals his transgressions will not prosper, but he who confesses and forsakes them will find compassion. Now, brother, I'm really not a big believer in walking the plank, as we facetiously refer to it. In churches of Christ, we developed in years gone by, you don't see it so much anymore, you know, quite a tradition of having people come forward to confess their sins. As a matter of fact, I don't see it maybe once a year in the last 30 years of my life. You don't see it so much as we used to, I'll agree. But, and once I'm glad for that, because the confession of sin, brethren, certainly, primarily, is a confession to whom? To your God. Now, if you sin against somebody, then what? You need to go and take care of that problem. You need to confess that sin to that individual, and you need to try to make it right as best that you can. But are the great majority of our sins really committed against somebody else? A lot of what we do, you know, it's just in secret, and a lot of what we do is thoughtless, and a lot of what we do, you know, doesn't necessarily have some terrible impact on somebody else, and a lot of what we do that would fit the category of sin is just neglect and disinterest and inactivity. Distraction and negligence, I think, are one of the biggest of the sins that must just gripe God something fierce. In a nation as wealthy and peaceful and with all the free time and all the conveniences to save us time, you know, that we have. So if you turn your ear away from the law, I know nobody on a Wednesday night is doing that, but those who do, they threaten their prayers for sure, but he will not prosper. Suggests in verse 13, you know, something not only with regard to God in the spiritual realm, but even on this earth as well. But confess them and forsake them, you'll find compassion. Now, I've seen a lot of people, you know, through the years and more in the past, you know, come forward and confess their sins to the congregation, and the congregation had no idea that they'd committed this sin. And then what happens? See, it really hurt and distressed and upset and be a stumbling block, you know, to other people. So this is one that kind of comes with a caveat, you know, and be really sure that you have to, you know, go public with something that everybody needs to know about. Maybe children in that audience, maybe. Now, I'm never going to forget it, brother. I think it was just the most heartbreaking and awful thing I ever saw in a church assembly. And I was only a couple of months old as a Christian, so you got to imagine, I'm really horrified. That first year, a couple of months, so I'm in this church, I'm having my very first experiences with the Church of Christ, in the ripe old age of 21 years of age. I got to know this young family, you know, just a great delight at them, in them. A young couple had a little boy who was maybe 4 or 5 years old. He is the cutest thing you ever saw in your life. And then he contracted some terrible disease. And it was something to watch as that young couple would come in every time we met with a little red wagon and a 4 or 5 year old boy in a full body cast. Only thing exposed were his hands and his feet. He was going to be like that for months and months. How that is for a little kid, you know, as rambunctious as they are. And there he was in that body cast. And that congregation fawned over that kid and loved that kid up like, you know, you can't imagine. He had the biggest grin, you know, everything. It's just wonderful. And then Daddy went on a business trip, committed adultery with a prostitute, and came back, told the whole church about it, with his wife and the kid there. Did we need to know that? I don't think so. And that whole church was just wrecked while this guy was trying to make himself feel better, you know, get his conscience clean. I think that was a humongous mistake. And it was buried so deep in my heart that day, as only a couple of months old, looking at that young wife and the tears, you know, just streaming down, the horror, the contortion, you know, of her face and body, and the little kid in the wagon. I'm just, you know, what are people thinking? So, brethren, verse 13. If you conceal your transgressions, you will not prosper. So don't do it. But if you reveal your transgressions, maybe everybody else you know will not prosper. So let's be careful with this. Confess them, forsake them. You'll find compassion. But limit them, you know, to the parties that are involved and nobody else, and or your God, of course. So we'll close like this. Brethren, when the book of Proverbs opened up and the play began, clear back in September, when we began, the first thing we saw was the purpose of the book. I'd like to have you go back there and have a look at it now. Proverbs chapter 1. In the first 6 verses, tell us what this book is about. The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, to know wisdom and instruction, to discern the sayings of understanding, to receive instruction in wise behavior, righteousness, justice, and equity. That is, to receive instruction in those 4 things. Verse 4, to give prudence to the naive, to the youth, knowledge, and discretion. Jonathan's just graduated from high school. We're so proud. Okay, we are. He is a youth. He is a young man. What was this book for? Jonathan, is for you. You're the youth. It'll bring you knowledge and discretion and prudence. These are the most valuable things that you can know in this life. So don't you forget it. I'm telling you. And then comes verse 5. A wise man, so I don't talk about the older ones, been around a while, will hear and increase in learning. You're supposed to be doing this increase all your life. And a man of understanding will acquire wise counsel. To understand a proverb and a figure, the words of the wise and their riddles. So he has just told you when the book started, this is a book you need to spend a whole lot of time with for the rest of your life while you are learning to understand proverbs and figures, the words of the wise, and their riddles, which are used extensively throughout this book to teach us about wisdom. But there was a second thing that it started with. After the declaration of its purpose, Look at verses 7 through 15. Actually, we're a little longer than that, but you get the gist of it there. And 7 through 10, really, we'll pull it off. The fear of the Lord is the what? The beginning. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. Verse 8. Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Indeed, they are a graceful wreath to your head and ornaments about your neck. More power to you if you grew up in a Christian home. Pay attention. Verse 10. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. Now, I'm going to skip the rest all the way down through verse 15, but that is our three-part what? Plan or steps to wisdom. There was our outline. You want to acquire all those good blessings in verses 1 through 6. Fear the Lord, heed your parents, and avoid sinners. Those three things is what Solomon wanted to lay down, and he built everything else, you know, on top of that. And now we come to the end of our play. So tonight, you know, the last of the Proverbs. How it ends up like that, actually. I decided we weren't going to spend a lot of time on that. I was chided by more than one woman as a result. And you were right. I'm not denying that for a minute. But there you are. Jonathan, marry a good woman. Okay. And you women, be one. So... younger ones that are as yet unmarried, and Jonathan will have some hope in the world. Okay? You know, what's the way that it closes? It gives us a mother's advice to her young son in that last chapter, the opening parts of which we talked about in the category of alcohol and or things that had to be involved in kings. And then it leads into this wonderful description of the worthy woman. Now, when I married Donna, when we, you know, merged our households, one of the first possessions of hers that, you know, I ever got to see was it was a photo, you know, frame under glass, but it was nothing more than the whole quote from Proverbs 31, a worthy woman. She is that. But when I met her as a very young woman, you know, she'd been keeping that in front of her. It was a gift from her mom, who also was a worthy woman. So that's how Proverbs ends up. I wish we could have had more time to deal, you know, with that. But it's a twofold discussion there in that chapter. It tells you how to be a worthy woman. It tells every young man, if he's got any smarts about it at all, that's the job description for your future wife. That's the woman that you look for.